There is a Quilpin committee who is the heads of the different specialized seminars, plus myself. So pass suggestions to me or to whoever's organizing seminars in your area. So just to say what the next several are in the fall, I'm going to see there's some holes still to fill up. Next week, we have Sean McGee, who is visiting from Queen Mary, who's going to talk to us about Dunkin' geometry and the origin of time. Then we have several talks, really the next three talks that are listed, which are part of a series that Maya Pachuski has been organizing since last term to introduce us to issues in statistical physics and the subject of complexity. So we have Mark Newman talking about academics, Erdos numbers in the internet, from Michigan, and Jürgen Kurz from Potsdam talking about synchronization as a paradigm of nonlinear science, and then Rekha Alpert from Penn State talking about models of genetic regulatory networks. Then we have Charlie Bennett, one of the founders of the field of quantum computation. Then we have a special day. This is the one talk with Stavros Sequenz on Friday, with Evelyn Fox Keller, who is a distinguished philosopher of science, as well as a physicist and a biologist. And this was the only day we could get her. She's written 10 lectures.
It's the fourth one. It's the fourth. November 2nd is a Wednesday, so it's
the fourth. So it's the fourth. Sorry. Then we have a particle physicist from Adelaide, and Philson Thompson talking about prion models, and then Philip Vanheim from Connecticut, who will be talking about alternative models to dark matter. He has one he's been pushing for many years. So there will be other additions to the schedule, keep posted, but that's what we have at the moment. Today, we're very happy and honored to start with Raphael Sorkin, and there's no better person to start with. Raphael is one of the most influential and imaginative people working in fields of relativity and quantum gravity, and we've been very fortunate to have him as a visitor here for a year and to continue his visit into this year, and he's going to tell us about causal sectors.
Thank you. Actually, the title and abstract that I gave you are slightly misleading. They were the title in my mind when I started to prepare the colloquium, but as it stands now, a somewhat better title might be Some Insights Derived from the Causal Set Program. So I originally did start to prepare a review talk on causal sets, but I realized that if I did that, I'd really never get to the end. And the end was in some way the most interesting part, which was going to be a list of some of the general insights for quantum gravity that I think this program has yielded. So even that list is fairly long, so I'm going to actually start with what would have been the conclusion. This carries the risk that I may never make it to the introduction, but never mind. So what I wanted to ask is not in space-time a causal set, which is essentially what the title was before, but what have we learned from quantum gravity? This may seem a funny question because, of course, we don't have a theory of quantum gravity yet. But on the other hand, we have a lot of pieces of such a theory, and from them we can derive both qualitative and semi-quantitative insights, and that's what I want to talk about. What I will be discussing comes mainly out of the causal set program, but we should see evident connections to loop quantum gravity, the non-commutative geometry, dynamical triangulation, string theory. Indeed, I believe that many of the insights I'm going to try to draw have a general applicability beyond just causal set theories. The only limitation, perhaps, is that most of them depend one way or another on some assumption of an underlying discreteness. So if you have some theory that's completely continuum from beginning to end, perhaps those are not insights for such a theory. So what I want to do then is to go through these acclaimed insights, of which there are roughly 10, briefly discuss them, then come back describe causal sets, what you can see as mathematical definition there, introduce the idea of causal set, and go back and justify a few, at least a few of the things that I'll claim in the beginning. If you want to read more, most of this corresponds to published work, not all of it, not some of the more recent ones. And most of it is, although it may seem a bit vague as I express it, corresponds to rigorously proved theorems or long calculations. And so that I just have to refer you to the web for the published papers. So this was my test sheet. You can see that the Sanford Sharpie does a good job of red. I felt it. But along the way, I noticed that it really had the central message of the talk repeated over and over again. That's why I left it up. So the main insight, almost the founding insight of causal set theory, is this statement that order plus number equals geometry. So I hope that'll become a little clearer what it means later on. But implicit in that is this sub-insight, which is that causal set, of course, is a discrete theory, as I mentioned, is that the discreteness, although it takes away degrees of freedom, which is, of course, what it's intended to do, it also adds information, the extra information being the volume information coming from number. What's the pointer here? I can find that anyway.
I will get to
the point. So, the idea of the causal set is not only that the causal order is somehow the most fundamental structure in space-time and is replicated in the underlying microscopic theory, but the space-time volume information, which is not captured by the order, is captured by counting. In other words, we're getting quantitative information from the discreteness. So, within that approach, what you notice soon is that the second insight I had here is that, and this is something that I should probably stress here at Primer Institute, because a lot of people have been interested in the possible phenomenological consequences of discreteness as violating Lorentz invariance. This does not happen in the causal set program, and in fact, the insight is that discreteness and Lorentz invariance can live together. They can live together quite well. They can. It's a successful marriage, but like all successful marriages, it takes a lot of work to make it, keep it going, and in fact, it takes a lot of work here. And so there are several consequences that you're forced to if you truly try to marry discreteness with Lorentz invariance. First of all, this basic hypothesis of the basic postulate of the causal set framework, which is that number equals volume, turns out to require Lorentz invariance. In a certain sense, you don't have a choice. I lay away a lot of weight on this in my own mind, because one could imagine a theory in which you relinquish Lorentz invariance. But from the causal set starting point, you can't give up this. You'd be throwing away volume information. And therefore, in a certain sense, you're forced to a discrete Lorentz invariance combination. In order to achieve this, it turns out, although this is not a theorem, it's a result of practical experience, that one requires a kinematic randomness. That is a one requires a kinematic randomness, that is not only randomness in the behavior of the causal set and its evolution, the kind of randomness that we're used to in a random walk, but randomness in the very notion of the correspondence between the discrete and the continuum. If you were to think of a causal set as being embedded in space-time, which of course you shouldn't do if you're thinking of the space-time as a background, but you should do if you're thinking of the space-time as an approximation to the causal set. If you were thinking of the causal set as embedded in space time, you should think of it as randomly embedded, something like the way a fluid is embedded in space, as opposed to the way a crystal is embedded in space. And this is a direct result of this requirement of uniformity, as I'll argue later. This also leads, this marriage of discreteness and Lorentz invariance also leads to a mixing of ultraviolet and infrared effects which I won't talk about unless someone asks me in the question period. I'll be saying this repeatedly. And then a new, it also leads to the conclusion that locality as a fundamental principle must be given up, although not causality. This follows essentially from the kind of structure that a random set deserving large invariance has, where the number of nearest neighbors is large or infinite in a limit of an infinite space. And so locality, even in a discrete setting, a discrete formulation, doesn't really make sense. This is perhaps an old insight, but something that at least I've only realized recently that could be a broad importance follows from this, which is that even if we give up locality, of course we have to recover it in some approximation if we're going to make contact with the real world. And in order to do this, it appears that an intermediate length scale will have to appear on which the non-locality survives, something much larger than the cutoff, say the Planck length. I'll identify the cutoff as the Planck length. Something much larger than the cutoff and yet much smaller than macroscopic scale. This seems to have been the same thing that has come in its own way out of non-commutative geometry, where, for example, the fuzzy sphere has three length scales, its radius, a sort of cutoff and an intermediate non-commutativity scale. Although I have no idea why it's come the same. I mean, one cannot see that the reason is the same in both cases, but it's a bit striking that the conclusion seems to be the same. At the, near the end of the talk, I'll try to give you the argument, at least briefly, that leads to this. By the way, another thing I should mention, because although I don't see John here, I know people here have worked, and many people have worked on the idea that non-locality as such, without a cutoff, might cure the perturbative infinities of quantum fields here. At least the way it comes about here, it not only doesn't cure them, it makes them worse. It's the cutoff that cures them, but you can't do it with non-locality alone. A further next on the list of insights concerns the problem of time. Now, you might ask me, if you're not working in quantum gravity, what is the problem of time? So I'd be tempted to answer that the way Louis Armstrong was alleged to have answered someone who asked him, what is the thing that they call jazz? And his reply was, if you got to ask, you'll never know. But that would not be a fair answer. The reason that I don't want to answer is that maybe I don't know, but what I do know is the answer to it. So the problem of time is implicitly defined by the answer that I'm giving here. By saying that the problem of time is solved, that was a bit facetious. I could go on at length about the problem of time, canonical gravity, and so on. But the answer to it is perhaps more interesting, even if you don't know the exact question, and that is that it is possible to come up with a background-free, generally covariant dynamics, and we have such a dynamic for causal sets. Furthermore, the observables of that dynamic, what you might call the observable, technically the label-free predicate, label invariant or label-free predicates, questions that you can ask meaningfully about the causal set and get a probabilistic answer from the dynamics, they're not only defined formally, but they're physically accessible. They can all be reduced to what are called stem predicates, which I'll just talk about again briefly later, but which are basically the question of what does the causal set look like at some finite stage in its growth, specifically given a certain finite causal set. Was there a phase in the growth of the causal set in which it agreed with that finite causal set? By background free, of course, I mean that the causal set grows through its own internal dynamics. It's not to be thought of as growing in some space-time where it doesn't require any background structure to define the dynamics. In contrast, for example, to string theory, which in its most standard formulation requires a fixed space-time in which the string evolves, but which is not from the beginning produced by the string. by covariant, generally covariant, what I really mean is that there is nothing like the coordinate system involved in the definition of the dynamics, which comes down to mean the causal set does not come with labels. Covariant and label invariant mean the same as the set. Now this dynamics is not quantum yet, unfortunately. It's classical. But as far as this problem of time is concerned, I think all the issues are there at the classical level. And one can anticipate that this covariance and background independence can be met or can be achieved in the same way in the quantum version of the theory when we have it. Some other point I wanted to make that I'm not remembering. So closely related to this problem of time, solution of the problem of time, as I've called it, is a somewhat more philosophical. Problem of time is actually a very practical problem about quantum gravity. How do you make meaningful statements within the theory? At a more philosophical level, the particular model that has solved this, as I claimed, also shows us something else of interest, which is I've expressed here by saying that covariance and becoming can coexist. So covariance, I said, I meant label invariant. By becoming, I mean, becoming, I mean that things actually happen, things change. It's often asserted in the context of relativity, both special and general, that a theory which is four-dimensional, like the Einstein gravity theory, demands us to think of the whole of a static universe, as philosophers call it, a block universe. That space and time are all laid out like in a movie. The future is there. We're just in some sense experiencing only a little bit of it. But there's no actual activity. There's no change. In the model for the growth dynamics, this causal set dynamics, the development of the causal set is actually described as a process. It's a process in which elements are born singly, come into being, and form relations, causal relations with pre-existing elements. And this repetition of this over and over again, according to a certain stochastic law, is a dynamic.
Is this becoming local, or is this a locality as to becoming an absolute? Is this becoming local, or
It's very not local. What will happen is that the new element will have, as immediate ancestors, a very large number, some of which stretch back to a time much earlier, in a particular frame, to a time that's much earlier than the time in which it was born. So there will be direct causal links, for example, between us and causal set elements or events at the near the time of the Big Bang. So that sense it's highly not local.
Yeah.
Just a question. So have you got an inbuilt arrow of time? And how do you think that's it? Well, that's an excellent question. I think the answer is yes. This dynamics does start with an inbuilt arrow of time. There are some special cases. It has some free constants in it, parameters, a coupling constants, and there are some cases in which the arrow of time actually is not there in the end. It's reversible. This is the so-called percolation, transitive percolation, or some extension of it. The infinite past time would be time reversible. The way the dynamics works, you actually build up a past finite causal set, which is what I've written here. So any element has only a finite number of ancestors. But that particular model has a natural extension where elements can have an infinite number of ancestors. Give the world a plan.
Since I think you're going to be introducing the model in detail,
thanks for that. Another insight concerns the cosmological constant in a couple of ways. And this is the forecast, if you like, that the cosmological constant might be a non-local and quantal residue of the underlying discreteness of the causal set. Now, this actually was a prediction from causal set theory, what I call heuristic prediction. That was of about 15 years longevity now, so well before the supernova data, for example. And what it predicted was that we would see a fluctuation in the cosmological constant of order 1 over root n being the number of causal set elements in the universe up till now. Of course, I'll talk about that in more detail later, but it seems to be very compatible with what has been observed recently, so far as the model goes. It's interesting that if this is right, and if what we are seeing is these discreteness-induced fluctuations, in other words, if the supernovas are really illuminating for us the underlying spatiotemporal discreteness, it's a kind of remarkable conclusion. But if that's true, then it's also interesting to observe that the dimensionality of 4 is rather special. It's a critical dimension in the sense that below 4 dimensions, I think the cosmological constant dominates the dynamics. Above 4 dimensions, it's the scalar curvature. And so there's only a balance in 4 dimensions. And you can try to build from this a story that would explain why we live in 4 dimensions. I don't have a very convincing one to tell you, but it is striking that 4 is the critical dimension from this point of view. A second observation that's also to do with the cosmological constant is also to do with something that's a problem for almost every approach to quantum gravity, certainly those which assume something different from space-time deep down, especially something discrete. This is an observation that I know Lee is often harping on, in good sense of harping on, reminding people what's important. And that is that it's not at all obvious in such a theory why one should ever see a continuum coming out of it. I mean, the causal set can be, that's the key insight of order plus number equals geometry. It can be like a space-time, but it need not be like a space-time. In the same way, the things used in dynamical triangulations or spin networks, none of these things need to be, or spin foams, none of them need to be like a space-time. So why are they? Why do we see continuum behavior? So I'm not giving you the answer to this, but what I want to, I wish I could, but what I want to say is that this is not a further problem that we have. This is actually the same as the problem of the cosmological constant in a different guise, or at least very intimately connected with it. The reason is not hard to see. If you ask why is lambda approximately zero, what you're asking is why is it not of its typical order of magnitude, which should be set by the Planck scale? Suppose it were of that order of magnitude. Then in the continuum picture, you would have curvature on Planckian scales. If you have curvature on Planckian scales, you can't also have discreteness on the Planckian scales. It's like you can't describe a shock wave in a fluid whose thickness is less than the space in between molecules. It just doesn't make sense. So if the cosmological constant were to have the magnitude it naively would have, you just wouldn't have a continuum. In that sense, the explanation of why you can get a continuum at all has to also tell you at the same time why lambda is so much smaller than it might otherwise have been. For reasons that I won't have time to say here, non-locality, I think that the keys to this might be non-locality, but together with quantum interference, that is constructive interference for the
So you
think
that lambda is the kind of intermediate scale that you were referring to earlier?
No, that's a good question. No, I didn't mean to say that. I realize there's a potential confusion there. Lambda, I'm assuming, is associated with the Planck scale. The same argument would still work if lambda were to be associated with the intermediate.
I think your point is that lambda isn't observed to be.
It's not observed to be either of
the more intermediate size.
That's right, but
it corresponds to the continuum.
But it's a size that's so small that it's not, that we can't even expect to see non-locality on it. So if there is an intermediate non-locality, lambda still has to be smaller than the scale set like that by that, so there's still this problem. Another consequence of the, I should say that this argument on cosmological constant relies on, at least in a hand-waving way, it relies on the dynamic, the model, the sequential growth model for dynamics that I discussed before, that I alluded to before and will discuss later. Another thing that follows from that I just mentioned because there's no time to say more about it, is a mechanism by which the large numbers of cosmology might be understood without inflation as reflecting the large age of the cosmos itself, if you like, many cycles of expansion and collapse. I won't say any more, except to mention that what makes this possible is a kind of renormalization, a different sort of renormalization, that is associated with the bounce, where when you come out of the bounce, the coupling constants that describe the new dynamics change. This is strongly reminiscent of the kind of thing that Lee had speculated about in the context of, I don't like to say it this way, but the anthropic principle. It's got something about it, but anyway, it's reminiscent, but it's also different in a way because the normalization is deterministic and not random.
What is bounce?
Bounce means if the universe expands and collapses down to zero size and re-expands, that's colloquially called by people working in cosmology and bounce. So I should call it a re-expansion of the universe after a collapse. So in this kind of model, it goes through many of those cycles. The coupling constants change, and they change in such a way, secularly, systematically, so that each new expansion is more and more like the universe we live in now, in a big flat,
question about your London. Shouldn't it be positive or negative? The sun doesn't seem to be determined.
That's absolutely correct. The sign is not determined. So the prediction was for the order of magnitude. It put just as well as the negative.
And should it change in time as well?
Absolutely. Yes. Or at least it's very likely. I mean, we can come back to ask me that question again. But yes, typically it will change in time, but maybe not as often as you might think.
Is the narrow of time tied to the fact that you're adding elements as opposed to removing elements?
Absolutely.
In fact, the universe would be going back.
I should stress this. The elements are like space-time atoms. They're not space atoms. They're element events. They're not element points of space. So even as the universe contracts, elements are being added.
So in our current universe, what would cause it to contract?
What we call the universe?
Well, I mean, you know, all the data suggests that it's not going to.
If lambda remains as it is.
Right.
But if lambda is fluctuating, then in this model, what happens is that lambda, I mean, I'll talk a little bit about this prediction later. That led to an order of magnitude. It can be, well, me is looking, maybe I should put this up. So the brief answer is that it may well change sign in some way. Okay, then we would just point it out. And then you could easily get a contraction.
But on what kind of time scale?
Hubble time scale. I should say that these things I'm talking about here are not in the same model as cosmological constants, because that's based on the quantum dynamics, which we don't yet have. It's based on some anticipations of what the quantum dynamics would look like. These are actually provable results, but in a classical model, which is not totally compatible. So it's just an indication, the kind of explanation we might hope to get for some of these large numbers. The last insight having to do with this sequential growth model, these dynamical models for causal sets, is that causality and general covariance, by which I always mean label invariance, is a very restricted combination and leads almost uniquely to a particular family of dynamical laws, the particular ones that I call classical sequential growth dynamics. In other words, causality has the potential to play the same kind of guiding role that locality is playing for us in the case of classical general relativity. In the case of classical general relativity, the Einstein equations come out almost uniquely from the assumptions of locality and general covariance. If we don't have locality, we might ask, what would lead us to the right dynamical quantum laws for a causal set or any other model? This is something that string theorists often comment on, that they feel they lack some guiding principle that can lead them to the right formulation of string theory. Well, the observation here is that causality is almost as powerful in this context of the sequential growth models as locality was in the classical theory. And maybe that's the right replacement. So we hope that it will lead us to the quantum sequential growth model, which should be the quantum gravity from the causal set point of view. If not, then what? Here's a couple of suggestions, but I don't think I'll take the time to say more what they mean right now. Less unknown, almost less. So a further insight, also related to the dynamics of causal sense, is that I think it's fair to say, certainly within the causal sense program, that we can't do quantum mechanics as usual. Not only, we can't do business as usual quantum mechanically, just as we can't do it from the point of view of space-time. Not only is space-time being replaced by something radically different, but the dynamics needs at least to be changed to some extent. It needs to be a generalized quantum mechanics, which I think is a term of Jim Hartle. By saying that, what I mean is that it needs a history's formulation that can do without unitarity. This would be seeing quantum mechanics, and this is my view of it, as a kind of generalization of classical stochastic processes and classical megatheory, as opposed to a generalization of Hamiltonian deterministic mechanics. One can give arguments, coming basically from the non-locality that I keep referring to, that we can't expect a unitary theory, even for a field on a background causal set. And we can't expect that even if the full theory were unitary, but beyond that, we shouldn't expect that the full theory of quantum gravity is unitary. So again, just to briefly allude to some of the arguments people have given, one that many people will be familiar with is the information loss in black holes, of course a contentious topic. But there are also reasons specific to causal set theory why unitarity doesn't seem possible. It's basically coming from the fact that time is discrete and there can't be a Hamiltonian, and all the good arguments for unitarity rely on Hamiltonian. Moving somewhat into a phenomenological direction, well, the cosmological concept was, of course, phenomenological, so I should say returning to a phenomenological direction, but not yet laboratory phenomenology, because we haven't made black holes in laboratories. We certainly haven't confirmed black holes in the dynamics experimentally. But if we take it as a given of quantum gravity, since there's so many good arguments for it, then we can call it part of the phenomenology. And I just want to mention that black hole entropy could be understood as a number of discrete constituents of the horizon, what I've called here horizon molecules. I'll say a little bit more about that later. This is very analogous to the way in loop quantum gravity one sees the entropy as, in some way, basically counting the number of punctures in the horizon due to elements of the graph of the spin network, or the loops, if you like. We also will see here a hint of there's something along these lines that gives also a hint of a connection to the holographic entropy bound. That I will mention in the question period if someone wants to ask about it. And then finally, moving seriously into the discrete. By the way, I wasn't saying sort of stuff. I wonder if someone could open a door and maybe let some air. That's a noise. So get moving towards something that really is phenomenological. The last point I want to make, again, it's one that I think is very at home in Perimeter Institute, where people have been seriously thinking about the possible phenomenological consequences of an underlying discreteness. The observation here is that discreteness can have dramatic dramatic phenomenological consequences, even while respecting Lorentz invariance, which it's bound to do from the causal set starting point. And I've listed here the three main ones. First of all, that if the underlying space-time, or the replacement for space-time, is discrete and randomly distributed, it's not going to be possible for any particle to follow an exact geodesic. So there must be some kind of deviation from that. That leads to a diffusion in velocity space, which because of the Lorentz invariance is highly constrained and described by one phenomenological parameter. Perhaps with some goodwill, we've seen this in the cosmic ray spectrum. But in any case, it's something that's there and bounds would be set up. Related to this is to do with propagation not of particles in the causal sense, but of fields, scalar fields specifically. Again, there will be deviations from the scalar wave equation And maybe they will even be so big as to rule out this approach altogether, which would certainly be dramatic. Anyway, the main message is that they're bigger than you might think, related to this intermediate length scale. The third one is something I've already mentioned, which is the fluctuations in the cosmological constant. One thing that I didn't mention before, I did mention that 4 was a critical dimension, but I didn't mention that if you take this seriously as the explanation of the so-called dark energy, it actually, unfortunately, excludes the large extra dimension scenarios that people have put forward. The reason being that in those scenarios, the fundamental Planck scale is very different from what we think, and the fluctuations turn out to be way too small to give rise to the observed cosmological constant or dark energy. So that concludes the conclusion. So now let me get to the introduction, actually. And that comes now, which is discrete. So causal set, so now I'm going to introduce the causal set theory idea more in somewhat more detail, starting with the idea that it's a discrete theory. So you'll see, I've seen that many of these insights rely on discreteness in a fundamental way. And so I think it's worth, and certainly causal set is a discrete theory. So it's worth recalling the reasons that people have self-driven to some sort of discrete model of quantum gravity. Is there some question?
Usually people talk about discreteness in connection with the Planck length, but you say you have a classical theory. So you have a classical theory which is discrete about the length.
That's true.
So what sets the scale of the discreteness?
Well, in that theory, nothing sets the scale, but hopefully in the quantum version of the theory, it will be defined. What you're saying is just a simple, actually, very natural observation is that, what is it, the square root of h star g, or the Planck length, it's a fundamental length for quantum gravity, and if h bar goes to zero, then it goes to zero, so you might expect that you're in a continuum. And I rather believe that that's true. So I don't think that this classical theory that we have is the classical limit, exactly, of this. It's not. It's a classical analog, and it's meant as a sort of testing ground in which we can explore ideas like general covariance, like the problem of time, and so on. So it's meant as, if you like, as a warm-up, and an indication of the kind of effects that you might find. It's not meant as a classical limit. So, this of course goes to zero, goes to zero. So why do we want discreteness? Well, I argued earlier and will argue again, or I claimed earlier and will argue in a moment, that we actually gain a lot from discreteness. We gain volume information, that it's the basis of length itself. But leaving that aside, there are of course a lot of practical problems that people have hoped to cure, and those are what you can call the infinities. The very first infinity goes back to the very beginning of quantum mechanics, when the black body problem was under investigation, and there was the so-called ultraviolet catastrophe, which is that if you heat up a box of, more or less an empty box, when you heat up the electromagnetic field inside, you'll find an infinite energy inside. Well, quantum mechanics, as we all know, solves this in the following sense, that the cubic infinity that we used to have became a quartic infinity. So, in other words, no one laughed, but in other words, it didn't solve it. It made it worse, and we still have that problem. It's under the name, and it's not to say it didn't do anything, but it didn't solve that particular problem. And it's still with us, it just has a different name. It's called the problem of the cosmological constant. That's the very beginning, earliest infinity that I know of the quantum theory.
The temperature depends on the made by.
Yes, the difference is.
Well, that's because it's observable.
Yes, that's fine. So I said it didn't do nothing. But the same thing in gravity, where the singularities imply curvatures going to infinity, and this means we have structure on infinitesimally small scale, or arbitrarily small scale. In standard model, this is perhaps not commented on so much, but I think it's generally accepted that we don't actually believe the standard model, which is our best quantum field theory today. Not that we don't believe it, but we don't believe that it has a true continuum limit. We believe it breaks down at some small, but nevertheless finite scale. Furthermore, when you put together quantum mechanics and general relativity, rather than the hoped for amelioration of these problems that many people had anticipated, it actually gets worse. Quantum gravity is not perturbatively renormalizable, although we had an interesting talk on how it might be not perturbatively renormalizable. But at least, most straightforwardly, the problem gets worse. Gravity does not cure the infinities of quantum field theory if the continuum is retained. Another thing that comes when you put together quantum field theory and general relativity, another infinity is the infinite entanglement entropy of black holes. The cutoff will, of course, stop this, and in fact, can lead to an entropy of just the right order of magnitude. In my mind, that's one of the strongest evidences we have for the question that some people are asking is really, where is the discreteness scale? The correspondence to black hole entropy seems to me some of the best evidence for setting that scale at the Planck scale. Another thing to do with black holes is the continuum-induced infinite number of horizon shapes, again, would lead to an infinite entropy, presumably, and would be cured by a cutoff. The problem in all these cases is, of course, the assumption that arbitrarily small distances make sense. This is not a new observation. In fact, I guess it's as old as black body radiation, and it's certainly been noticed by several people. This being the year of Einstein, I should certainly include a quote from Einstein, but not this. That was my backup transparency in case the projector didn't work. So this is the quote from Einstein. This is from about 50 years ago, and then there's a quote below it from Riemann about 150 years ago, both of which express the idea that we may be living in a discrete universe. And in fact, saying something that sounds an awful lot like a causal set model of this discrete universe. So Einstein wrote, the alternative continuum, this continuum, seems to me to be a real alternative, i.e. there is no compromise. In a discontinuum theory, space and time cannot occur. It will be especially difficult to derive something like a spatiotemporal quasi-order, in my terms of partial order, which is what a causal set is. It will be difficult to derive something like spatiotemporal quasi-order from such a schema, but I hold it entirely possible that the development will need it. Second quote, about 100 years before that, from Riemann's inaugural address, was, determinate parts of a manifold are called quanta. Their quantitative comparison occurs for discrete manifolds through counting, for continuous ones through measurement. So he's pointing out two things there. First, that there can be discrete manifolds. Indeed, he thought they were the more obvious kind of manifold, more natural ones that everyone understood and didn't bother to even give an example in his talk. But not only can there be discrete manifolds, but for them, measurement information, metric information, comes through counting. That's exactly what happened in the case of the causal set. Without jumping around the causal set yet, let's ask, if we're going to have a discrete structure to replace space-time, what should it be? Either you're extremely creative and you just invent some totally new structure, which is not out of the question, or you grasp onto something that's already present in the continuum, what I call a bridge back to the continuum. In other words, if your discrete structure is to give back under suitable circumstances a space-time, it's easiest if it has some feature in common with the space-time that can help to make the correspondence. That could be the topology, the metric, the order, the spin structure, coordinate functions, many things. This is a slide that I made about 10 years ago. It's interesting that all the approaches that I have here, I mean, that I don't know of any new approach that's arisen since that time that's already on the slide. So it's not so easy to think of anything. A possible exception would be spin foams, but I think that essentially can be included under the combination of Rudgers calculus and the loop quantum gravity approach. So people have tried to take each of these, because as the basic dynamic of triangulation is given. So, but the thing that leads you in the direction of causal sets is to take the causal order as the fundamental continuum structure, the one that has its echo and its correspondence in the underlying discrete world. In fact, the basic claim of the causal sets theory, or the impetus for it, is this statement, which is in some sense a rewording of what I had in the first insight. The causal order is arguably the most fundamental space-time structure, and certainly it's the logically simplest, much simpler than, for example, a Riemannian metric, if you were to try to think of mathematically what that is. And from it, we can get all the others, all the other geometrical ones. Now, how does that work, and what is the causal set? So, the causal set, well, I've written up there the definition. There's a set of elements provided with an order relation, which we can think of as the causal order relation, subject to those axioms of transitivity and irreflexivity, and some finiteness axiom, which I've given here in a strong form. But intuitively, it's just a kind of generalized family tree. In a family tree, there's an order relation, which is the order relation of being an ancestor and a descendant. Instead of saying X precedes Y, which is written usually like this, instead of saying X precedes Y, we can say X is an ancestor of Y. And then these axioms are automatic. And in fact, that's what does happen in this growth dynamic. The axioms then are automatic. You can't be your own ancestor. And someone who's the ancestor of your ancestor is also your ancestor. Like your great-grandparents' mother is also your ancestor. And these are, of course, the axioms of the causal order in space-time, which is defined by the availability curve of causal influence. So if event X can influence Y, and event Y can influence Z, then, of course, event X can influence Z. The basic ideas of how to get back a continuum from this, a space-time, are the two that I've been referring to over and over again, that the number of elements is to be equated to the space-time volume if you measure volume in the correct fundamental unit. So if you have some region of space-time, you think you're measuring its volume with rocks and rulers. What you're really doing indirectly is counting the number of elements, just like when you weigh a block of copper, you're indirectly counting the number of atoms in the copper block. The other part of the correspondence is the microscopic order corresponds to the macroscopic causal order. Here, by the way, is a little picture of a very simple causal set. Together, then, we get geometry from number and order. As I also emphasized before, discreteness is essential in this, because without discreteness, we wouldn't be able to count and get the volume information. We'd get at best a conformal metric, and not even that, really. If this approach were to succeed, it will unify all the structures of space-time, the topology, the differential structure, the metric, all in terms of one of them that's usually not talked about as much, which is its order relationship. It will also explain, in a certain sense, why is there a length. This is Riemann's observation, that because we can count, we can talk about things like distances. And specifically, it will tell us why the signature of the metric is Lorentzian and not some other, not Riemannian, as many people would like it to be. And some people, although I've never understood this, you actually get many, many very famous people saying that space time really is Euclidean, and we just perceive it as Lorentzian. Well, that couldn't be true in the causal set case, because, for example, if there were two time-like directions, you would get closed causal curves, and you would violate. You wouldn't be able to represent it as a causal set. I'll skip this. You can read it if you like, about coarse graining, and find out another one of the more remarkable predictions in causal sets, which is that there are no closed time-like curves, no time machines. So this is another one of the marvelous verifications of quantum gravity. Well, my friends have to make time machines have failed. So. What?
With regard to those axioms, I mean, the first two seem I don't see how you could do anything without it, but past finiteness seems to be somewhat more optional.
It's more optional. There's a weaker form of discreteness that I could put in there, but we do need some form of discreteness. The most natural one.
Well, why can't it be a count in the infinite set?
Then you couldn't count. You can't compare two countable. Oh, it is a countable infinite set, but any finite portion of it should be finite. That's the idea. So the weakening of that, we're saying the interval, the region causally between any two elements is finite. That would do. This is what comes out of the growth process. So I want to now describe the dynamics. What I've been describing so far is just the kinematics. So I want to describe, just give you a sense of how the dynamics works. It is, as I said, a growth process or a birth process. We can imagine it starting with what you see here, the empty set or no elements, and then a birth occurs, and so you have the only thing you can have is one element, which is that causal set. Second birth, there's already two possibilities. You can either have what's called a chain here or an anti-chain here. In other words, the second element is either a descendant of the first or not here and yes here. At the third stage, you have already more interesting possibilities. You have five in all. One of them can come in two different ways. Could be a child in this process of either the chain or the anti-chain, and so on. At the fifth stage, whatever this is, you have already too many to draw, but I've shown all the possible descendants of this particular, more interesting one, of three elements, and so on. So what you see is that the growth process traces an upward path through this diagram, which itself is a poset. It's a poset of all, poset is an impartial order. It's a diagram through this poset, the poset of finite causal sets. And the input, the process is defined by the transition probabilities at each stage. Given that you have this, what's the relative probability of getting this, this, or this at the next stage? There's of course a huge number of transition probabilities you can define. What makes leads you to a fairly unique set are these conditions of general covariance, which turns out to be path independence and implies that the process be Markovian, together with the causality conditions that I won't have time to describe, called Bell causality. Yeah.
So the process is happening in the background?
Absolutely. Yeah, so that's a very important observation. It's happening in a background time, but we don't want the background time to play a physical role. It's like a gauge. It's an element of gauge introduced into the description. And so we have to demand that the result of arriving at any particular causal set be independent of how that background time was introduced. That's the label invariance. That's what I mean exactly by general covariance in this setting. So it's in there.
We derive the background time from the
resulting causal set. All you derive is the true physical time, which is partial order. It says that this element is after this, but this and this are space-like and have no particular relationship. So it's just like, to write down the Einstein equations, you may need a coordinate system, but you demand that the equations be independent of the coordinate chosen.
So at this stage, you haven't said anything that restricted the dynamics of the classical.
No, that's right. So hopefully we would describe this by what's called the decoherence functional or quantum measure. But the particular dynamics we have, the thing that made it classical is where I talked about transition probabilities and not transition amplitude. Once I do that, then it's a classical, although stochastic. It's classical in the sense that a random walk is classical, a non-quantum entity, but not in the sense that it's deterministic. On the basis of this, we can prove a very nice theorem that tells that does solve the problem of time. However, I have a problem with time that I see, so I'll refer you to the literature. You can read very fast. Here it is. You know the definition. But what it tells you is that in this dynamical law, taking into account this need for label invariance, you can characterize abstractly exactly what are the observables, and then you can prove that every one of them is a logical combination of these stem questions or stem predicates, each of which has a direct physical meaning. So we not only know the observables, but we know what they mean. Not only know what we can talk about, but we know what we are talking about when we do so. Which in a nutshell is what the problem of time is about. So I wanted to get to the argument for the fluctuating cosmological constant, because that's certainly one of the most that has the most immediate observational interest. We did start a little late because of the introduction, so can I go a little bit? So here is the heuristic prediction. Here was the basis of the heuristic prediction for the fluctuating cosmological constant. To remind you then that the fluctuations in lambda were of the order of magnitude of 1 over root v, being space-time volume in Planck units. Space-time volume, not spatial volume. So we just saw, although very briefly, that in the sequential growth dynamics, the number of elements plays formally the role of the time. It's this background time, the auxiliary time that you talked about. So there's correspondence between n and t at the formal level. Now, if we think about quantum mechanics in a path integral formulation, we integrate over a lot of things, but one of them is not the time. In the sum over history, the time itself fits. So we would expect, if this analogy holds true, we would expect to fix n in doing some sort of sum over cosets that would lead to the causal set dynamics in the quantum case. However, it's a basic part of the causal set hypothesis that number means space-time volume. So if we were to take this to heart in the continuum, we would do the sum over histories fixing the space-time volume. This actually has a name and has been explored. In fact, this version goes back to Einstein, but he didn't express it in path integral language, of course. And it's called unimodular gravity. If we do this, the result is that the cosmological constant becomes, instead of an input parameter in the Lagrangian, it becomes a free constant of integration. The reason is that to hold fixed the volume, you need to introduce a Lagrange multiplier, or you can introduce a Lagrange multiplier, and then it combines with what you might call the bare cosmological constant, lambda naught, to give an effective one that's really at your disposal. In other words, a constant of integration. Another thing that you see from thinking in this way, in the continuum, is, and this can be made precise in different ways, the nicest way is a Fourier transform argument, but it's been observed repeatedly that cosmological constant and the space-time volume are conjugate in the same sense that time and energy are conjugate back in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So we would expect an uncertainty relation of this form, delta lambda, delta v of the order of h bar. But this is if we took n equals v as an exact statement in the continuum. It's not, and for a reason that I hope will become clearer in a few minutes when I discuss why we need the kinematic randomness. But if we think of the causal set corresponding to the space-time, we must think of it as if the space-time had been sprinkled randomly with elements, what's technically called the Poisson process. In this Poisson process, the number doesn't equal the volume exactly, but only up to Poisson fluctuations, which in the limit of large n are root n fluctuations. Since n is about v to sufficient accuracy, we can call them root v fluctuations. In other words, holding fixed n results in fluctuations in v on the order of root v. Putting that together with the uncertainty principle relation gives fluctuations in lambda of the order of 1, or h bar over square root of delta v, which is 1 over v. Now, if, and this is a big if the fluctuations are about zero, that's the other prong of the cosmological constant problem. Why are they about zero and not some other number? But if they're about zero, then we get a prediction of the order of magnitude of lambda itself from its fluctuation. If we specialize that to the present epoch, then, well, we ask how many, in our past, how many elements of the causal set are there, assuming Planckian unit magnitude for the basic space-time volume. then if the answer is about 10 to the 240, just roughly. If you take the square root, you get 10 to the 120, and of course, 10 to the minus 120 is the famous order of magnitude of the dark energy, which also equals the order of magnitude of ordinary matter. Well, I shouldn't say ordinary matter. We don't know what it is. But then more ordinary matter.
Are there some units
in
10 to minus 120?
No, that's an absolute number. So the statement is that the problem of the constant is normally expressed as units, so you have to throw in atomic density. So atomic energy density times 10 to the minus 120 is the typical magnitude.
And is that okay?
Yes, that's what it seems. If we identify this, what people call, this is an irony, I don't know, we've been talking, thinking about cosmological constant for years, and now that we see it, people have changed its name. So they call it the dark energy. Okay, so this dark energy isn't precisely that ordinary magnitude. Another thing I'm going to skip, so I'll let you look at the pretty picture, is the way that the counting of the black hole entropy plays out in causal sense. I just mentioned two things without explaining it, which is that if we compare it, for example, to the string theory account of black hole entropy, it's worse in one way and better in one way. The way in which it's worse is it's really still at a kinematical level. It's not within a full dynamical quantum theory of quantum sense. The only way in which it's better, however, is that it applies not only to equilibrium and extremal black holes, but it applies to equilibrium non-extremal and non-equilibrium black holes, highly non-equilibrium holes. For example, a fresh black hole that's just formed where it's arising and still expanding at the speed of light. And it also needs more work to be done properly in four dimensions. Anyway, I don't want to say much about that, I do just want to mention here that there's an echo here of the holographic bound. Since there are many people interested in string theory here, I'll just state it, leave it for the question period if anyone wants to hear more or later, which is that if you ask, you may not even hear what I mean by this, but if you take a region of space, time, a region of space, say a volume V, an area A, and take future domain of dependence, which is the region of space-time, and ask for the number of maximal elements of the causal set in that region, it actually scales like the area, the boundary of the region V, and not as V itself. So that's an interesting echo of what's called the holographic entropy zone. The last thing I want to do now is to come back to the randomness of the embedding, the randomness of the correspondence between the discrete and the continuum, and the consequences that that particular kind of discreteness may have for phenomenology. So to do that first, I want to say why am I so sure that the embedding needs to be random? Well, one thing, you may just be in love with Lorentz invariants. I think I said Lorentz, but you might, and that's the only way we know to make a Lorentz invariant embedding. But there's another reason, which is in some way more important from the causal set point of view, is that we need to get a uniform embedding. You say, well, why couldn't, in other words, we need to comply with the axiom that volume equals number. So if you take some nice regular region in space-time, which is really not a space-time, but really a causal set, the number of elements in that region should, to a good approximation, give its volume. So here we see an embedding that's nice regular, one plus one dimension or diamond lattice, that looks fine. It's got a certain size, and it's got the right number of points in it of the causal set. But what if we look at the same picture in a boosted reference frame? Then what we see, this nice regular array looks like this. Big gaps, and then very highly condensed lines of points. So now there are regions which are big and empty, and regions which are small and filled with many points. In other words, the embedding looks uniform in this frame, but it's really not, as we see by looking at it in the boosted frame. in contrast, the Poisson process, this random distribution of points, is Lorentz invariant and is uniform up to the Poisson fluctuation. So this sprinkling produces what you might call a random lattice, and this is the kinematic role of the randomness that I keep harping on. Let me show you the same thing again, just briefly. In the computer generated off just a little bit more accurate, but just showing the same thing. This is the original lattice, and this is the boosted lattice. A much more dramatic thing now is the generated, what you get if you take a Poisson string. Many people are quite skeptical about this for a while. Now, this, I hope, when they first hear of it, I hope that this will lay to rest the skepticism. So here, this is something generated by, I think David Rydell produced this, which shows first a region of two-dimensional Minkowski space and a random Poisson sprinkling with elements. And then in here, there's a small portion of it, which is blown out here on the right. You can see it's random distribution. Now we apply a boost to this, and we get this funny parallelogram shape. Of course, we didn't take the infinite space, so this becomes empty. Within that, the same region is this little red thing. And now we blow it up again. And there it is. Of course, in every detail, it's not the same. But I think you'll agree that it looks, to all intents and purposes, equivalent to the original. But this whole distribution looks exactly the same in the boosted frame as it looks in the original frame. Anyone want to disagree?
So is that because one direction is unaffected and the other one is scaled, but the distribution is scaled invariant?
The distribution is not scaled invariant. It has a scale and it has a very definite density. So if I were to sprinkle this at twice the density, you would see something very different. Or if I sprinkle it at much lesser density, you'd see something very different.
What I mean by that is the probability that 2 points have particular distance.
I don't think, neighboring is a problematical statement in the Lorentzian setting, but if we use the Euclidean distance, then that's not true, right? I mean, if they're sprinkled at a certain density, then you're going to find the neighbors at about that distance, point, but the nearest neighbors will not be at a much greater distance. It's not some power law or something like that, it's more of an exponential.
But you have points at arbitrary distance, you have points arbitrary, but also arbitrary.
Yes, it's true. This is true, but not in the scale invariant. So,
why is that? You said if you rescale, you get the same distribution.
There's no rescaling. I didn't explain it clearly. There's no rescaling going on. The relationship between this and this, there's a rescaling in the picture, that's the confusion.
The Lorentz contraction.
But the Lorentz contraction is a contraction in space. But to go with that, there's a dilation in time. When you put them together, and this is the key point, when you put them together, the space-time volume doesn't scale, doesn't change. It's neither contracted nor expanded. In other words, space-time volume is an invariant of the Lorentz contraction. That's why the Poisson contraction can be and is invariant.
Maybe we can save this for the questions.
Okay, so let me rush. So the first consequence, suppose this is what space-time really is like deep down. And say we're living in a function of Minkowski space. Deep down it's really a causal set of the sort that I showed you before, except in four dimensions. What implications would that have? One thing is for propagation of particles through this medium. So here I take an extreme idealization where the particles are point particles, even at the causal set scale. In other words, it's just a sequence of elements in the causal set, you can see that you're not going to have an exact space-time geodesic because the points corresponding to that just won't be there. Some jitter, sitter behavior, must be induced. You can make many models of how this would happen, but for phenomenological purposes, the really important thing is that since the underlying structure is Lorentz invariant, it's going to lead to a Lorentz invariant effective description, which can be then described by a diffusion in velocity space. I've written down the equations, just so you can cave it in if you like. But The important thing is that there's one free parameter here, a phenomenological parameter, which is this diffusion constant k, and none other because of Lorentz invariants. This actually shows the diffusion in proper time, it's just a Fokker-Planck equation to get model in proper time. But we, of course, will run in laboratory time. There's some subtlety in converting between those two, but it can be done, at least for this equation that you see here, in which t is laboratory time. This W here is a phenomenological addition to it that represents a damping that would be relevant to cosmic rays, like from the CMB. But if we leave that out, then to compare the equations, then this and this are the same equation. The important point here is that we can actually begin to set bounds on K. And if we're very optimistic, we can even hope that we're actually seeing this diffusion in the rather scalar invariant spectrum of the cosmic ring. The other thing that I have, I'll just put this up briefly. This I didn't have time to prepare a proper slide, I hope you can read it. This has to do with the scalar field, not particle on a causal set, but a scalar field on a causal set. What are the effects of discreteness on it? To answer that, we could say, suppose it satisfies the discrete analog of the scalar wave equation, box plus equals zero. So we have to say, well, it's box. What is the discrete analog of the Donald-Gershon causal set? If you're used to Euclidean problems, you will not begin to appreciate how previously difficult it is to come up with something like this. In fact, I think in a certain sense, it might not even be really possible to come up with something like this if you're in a truly infinite Minkowski space. But we're not in a truly infinite Minkowski space, of course. And it turns out that in the setting we are, it is possible to write down a remarkably simple formula that gives, in some continual limit, a good approximation to the box operator. What makes it so difficult is the fact that can come up in a few of the questions, which is that the number of nearest neighbors, naively, if you wanted to write down the discretization of box, you would take some nearest neighbor differences. But the number of nearest neighbors in the causal set is not a finite number in the limit of an infinite space, it's an infinite number, precisely because of the Lorentz invariants. So this is also related to what you were asking before. If there's any nearest neighbor, then by boosting it, you get another potential nearest neighbor, and the boosts are a non-contact subgroup of the Lorentz group. And so you seem to be stuck with an infinite number of contributions, it just doesn't make sense. What's really remarkable is that this simple combination allows the unwanted contributions to cancel out and give you in the continuum limit what you really want.
So, excuse me, how do you get a continuum limit if you don't have a fundamental scale which you take to zero?
Oh, there is a fundamental scale. I was trying, in answer to Hakeem's question, I was trying to stress that there is a fundamental scale.
But when you introduce your causal set, there was no mention of the scale.
So sprinkling into volumes.
This is the thing that Riemann was pointing out. The causal set is a discrete manifold, it's a discrete kind of space, and so it has its own scale built into it. If I want to know the distance between two causally related elements, I could ask, what's the longest chain, the longest set of intermediate elements that I can find, the analog of the geodesic? That's a finite number. All I have to do is then multiply that finite number by some dimensionable number, which I'll choose to be 10 to the minus 32 centimeters, roughly, the quantum. That's how the scale gets in. So the discrete...
Isn't that because you're randomly sprinkling the things, and so typical distance between them on average is going to be a fixed amount, which is...
Well, I don't know about typical distance, that's a very dodgy question.
No, but what
do you think? It's better to say in terms of, roughly speaking, yes. It's better to say the typical volume per element, that's the more well-defined thing. There will be a certain well-defined volume per element, and that. But I should stress, the point of view is not that we start with the space-time sprinkle, the point of view is that the space-time is an approximation to this quantum sprinkle. But anyway, that's perhaps it. Side point for the purpose of it. What you said is exactly right. So does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
I'm still a bit confused because you need to do the time claim, but you said this is classical, so
The point I wanted to make is that although this miraculous formula worked, I didn't say what it meant. I mean, take the value of, suppose you want the value of box 5 at the point, at the element y is above the set. Take minus 1 half the value of phi at y, add in the sum of phi at all the parents, the ones that are one link to the thing, subtract out twice all those of the grandparents, those which are in distance 2 from it, in this causal sense, and then add back in all the great grandparents with this. Well, that's basically it. That gives you the box 5. But it had, in a limit it works, but at any finite scale, before taking the limit, it has huge fluctuations. If you don't, really gigantic fluctuations, if you can't live with those, which I expect we can't, you need a much more subtle form. The remarkable thing is that exists also, but it demands this intermediate length scale. That's where the intermediate length scale actually comes in. And it functions as a non-locality scale in the theory of an order of magnitude of L over root epsilon, where L is the fundamental scale and epsilon, well, epsilon is just this parameter in the formula that I wrote down. This is bound to have, if we approach the non-locality scale, dramatic effects on the propagation of the scalar field, and some rough order of magnitude estimates, as I mentioned earlier near the beginning, suggest that it might even be so big as to make the whole thing unviable. That remains to be seen, especially because the formula I showed you was for 2 dimensions, and the analogous formula exists in 4 dimensions, but it's not yet understood as well. So what I wanted to do in ending was to repeat the conclusion in the proper place, but since it really is getting late, I think I'll skip repeating it and hope that maybe you remembered some of the listed insights that I began with and just finish with the thought that maybe applies not only to this, but to many approaches to quantum gravity. Many insights gained, but much work remains.
I'm a little confused as to where energy conservation would fit into all this. I mean, that family tree, you create a bit of space-time and then it has descendant bits, but in the Einsteinian sense, space-time is energy or has an energy content. So does energy conservation break down in the early universe?
I would think so, yeah. I mean, the real answer is I don't know the answer to your question, but I don't see any reason to. But I mean, I'm getting a little confused by your statement, because even in the continuum, there's no. In the cosmological setting, what does one mean by energy conservation?
Well, I agree, that's an issue itself. But here, there's a more discretized version, and it looks like, I mean, my superficial impression was there was no regard or attention paid to conserving energy. If you needed it in space-time, just pull it out of thin air. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And no, that is absolutely right. But, I mean,
but sometimes
in
the approximate sense, in the continuum.
Yes, I mean, there's certainly an issue of energy conservation. That's the issue of, you might ask, if the gravitational setting, you're saying, where do the Einstein equations come from? I would say that's the whole story, right? Because insofar as there is energy conservation in gravity,
particle creation and annihilation and all, you've got to have the.
Well, but isn't that it, right? If we write the Einstein equations down, for those who are not familiar with general relativity, it's the gravitational effect. But if we write that down and then take the divergence, we get. And then this is zero, identically, and therefore the divergence of the stress energy sensing. So I think that insofar as we have energy conservation at a classical level anyway, that it is all in the Einstein equation. So I think your question maybe could be phrased as, where do the Einstein equations come from? And, well, that's obviously a long story in which the ending isn't really known, but one way in which it could come if we can recover an effective locality, which we need to do anyway, because we've built in lines and variances, and if there's then there'll be some effective action, and the effective action just on dimensional grounds, the leading terms in it will be relatively abstract, relatively abstract, and so you will get this. I don't know if that really is.
So we can talk privately.
Well, I just wanted to comment that if you don't have time, you can't have energy conservation.
Certainly we won't have it as we won't have it as an exact statement in the theory. But it obviously must emerge at some approximation when time comes back, and that would be in a continuum approximation. And that would be the same approximation in which space-time itself makes sense, and which something like the Einstein equation could even be worked out.
But I think it's even worse, you don't have momentum conservation. So these swirls are actually violations of momentum.
Yes, those are certainly violations of momentum and energy.
And the other thing is because you're breaking translation invariance at the same time.
It's a microscopic way we're making it.
So at some point you recover continuum, presumably you recover momentum conservation on
average.
Maybe when you've got many points, I can see you could get energy momentum conservation approximately, but very early in the universe it looks like it just completely falls apart.
I think that's right. In fact, if you were to take seriously the picture of the very early universe. When I say very early, I mean very early in this cycle of expansion. Does that mean there may have been other cycles? But in our Big Bang, if you take seriously the picture that comes out of this classical model, you don't see, what you see is just a tree. So by a tree, I mean something like this, in which each element has exactly one immediate ancestor or parent. And you're expanding out of the Big Bang in a kind of tree phase. And so certainly nothing like a tree phase has any sense in that kind of phase.
In the quantum version of this, do you expect something like a fluctuating causal structure?
Oh, absolutely. The question is, yes. Now the question is, what does that mean? The causal set is the causal structure, so we could translate that to the statement, or to the question, do we expect a fluctuating causal set? Of course we do, but we have to say what that means. And the working hypothesis for a while has been that what that means is that we perform some sort of sum over causal sets, analogous to the sum over trajectories that one does in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. The sum over fields that one does in quantum field theory. So in other words, in rough sense, contributing to a given space-time would be very many causal sets differing in their kind of details, but all sharing the same coarse grain space-time.
Wait a minute, let me think a little bit, Daniel.
Yeah, so getting back to the cosmological constant. Presumably if it's fluctuating, it is fluctuating over space as well as over time, right?
That's an extremely important point. Right? So, presumably is the right word. So this heuristic argument I gave wasn't precise enough to answer that question one way or another. When all the recent data came out, we felt the need for a much more concrete model, a more comprehensive model. And we have made one up. And that could be on the verge of being ruled out, interestingly enough, because it predicts, I think the point you or someone made, well, I'm not sure who said it, but because of the fact that it was sometimes negative, sometimes positive, if we look back and we see that it's always up to a redshift of 3 or, I don't know, 3 maybe even more than, if it's up to a redshift of 2, you see it absolutely constant. That's already going to be very bad evidence for this model.
Right. Well, I was also going to suggest you can look in a different direction.
Absolutely right. So that was a preliminary to answering your question. So in this model, unfortunately, you built in spatial homogeneity in order to give meaning. There's a subtlety here, which is that it's not clear what one means by a learning cosmological constant. You can't just write down Einstein's equation. You can't just write down Einstein's equation, which with the cosmological constant, what do you say? with this like that, and make this function of space and time. If you do that, you run into a contradiction. This equation, by taking one derivative, the same calculation that I just did there, and this is term in it, tells you that the gradient of lambda is zero. So there's a real issue of, well, we got that prediction, it's supposed to be about the cosmological constant, but what exactly does it, how do we interpret it? And to give that, to do that interpretation, we assume homogeneity, spatial homogeneity. Now, Mahbub Ahmed, who's been together with Scott Robleson and Patrick Green, did the work on this model that I talked about. Mahbub is going on and he's trying to generalize the model to allow some amount of spatial homogeneity, at least a conformal near homogeneity and a conformal factor. It still seems possible to get a well-defined model. And then we'll be, and then, I don't know if this is what you had in mind, but there's a real risk there that there'll be way too much in homogeneity. And we'll see. And, or, but it may come out the other way. So, anyway, that's yet work in progress. But it's a very important question.
I still have a very basic question about your embedding. You talked about embedding, you showed pictures of embedding points on space, or in space. But you actually, how do you embed the actual relations, the causal relations?
So this is what.
And when you sprinkle things, how do you make sure that the things that are causally related in the poset appear causally related after sprinkling?
Right, so there are two inverse processes. So this is what we're really trying to do is define a relation that I might call the proximate equality. C is for the causal set, M is for the manifold. So we're trying to define some relation of approximate equality between causal set and manifold. The point of view is that this is primary, this is there only as approximation, when it gives a good approximation to the causal set. But in defining that, we're actually making it depend on an inverse process where you start with a manifold and you generate a causal set. The idea is that M gives a good approximation to C if C might have arisen by sprinkling points into M. So now what does it mean to sprinkle points into M? So when we're sprinkling points into M, M is there with its metric, and therefore with its like function and its causal structure. When we sprinkle, so here's M, and sprinkle points in, that gives us the elements of the causal structure. And then the order relation, because this is X and this is Y, this allows us to define the order relation. X precedes Y if and only if X is an element of what's called J minus of Y. J minus of Y, for those who don't know the notation, from general relativity, that's what that means, is that if and only if you can find a curve, future-going curve, which is time-like or null everywhere, that starts at X and ends in Y. So that gives a causal order, or partial order to space-time, and all we've done here to get C is to induce the causal order. Going the other way, you can't do a random thing anymore. If you start with C.
But you're talking about Poisson process. I mean, I understand the concept, but you, I don't see how to do it in practice in order to say that you would approximately discover or recreate the illusion of a causal matter.
Are you asking, if you gave me a causal set, how would I find out whether or not it would. Well, let me just try to notice my faithful invention. So if the causal set can be embedded in the manifold M in such a way that it looks like a Poisson sprinkling, in other words, if starting with C, I can find a manifold M and set of points, which is uniformly distributed density 1, and has causal relationships, agree with the causal relationships in C, I'll call that a faithful embedded C into M. Okay. Are you asking me how would
you actually, what I'm asking for is an embedding of the space of causal sets in the space of. What I'm saying is, as your causal set evolves, for example, you've got dynamics.
Yeah.
So how do you know that as it evolves, it will stay in the space of things which have an embedding in some manifold? So it's an approximate level, an approximate evolution of your ordinary manifold. Because we have to, at the end of the day, I want to know how you go from a causal set to an approximate prediction for evolution for GD, etc. And for that, I'd want to have some image, some
not completely foolproof, but some probabilistic mechanism for saying, here's my poster, here's what it would look like in some mechanism for giving points in the manifold, so such that as the filter set evolves according to your laws, that those points will also be imagined as evolving with some probability.
Well, the elements they don't evolve. What happens is the new elements get added. You're asking how do I know that the new elements would continue to be invisible in some way? No, I don't. Of course, the key issue I was raising. How do we know that the dynamic, when we have it, is going to give rise to something that's right? That's the same thing as me.
More than that, you'll say you've got causality, but actually what you've got is you've got what you call causality, and by definition, therefore you've got causality. But if you try to see what that will look like in terms of what we observe, then what you've got is approximate causality at best. So you've actually got fluctuating deviations from causality, something like that. So you are, in fact, predicting breakdown of causality from our perspective, not from your perspective, because by definition you've got causality. But in terms of what we observe.
So you've raised a lot of questions. Whether we have causality is partly a dynamic thing. There's something that I'm calling causal. Whether it actually functions physically as causality is a statement about the dynamic, even within the causal set point of view. That's something I just glossed over in the derivation of the sequential growth dynamic. But there is a very specific causality condition, which we call Bell causality. It does ensure that the causality has a physical meaning of causality. And whether or not, in the continual approximation, that would appear as a very kind of causality, I wouldn't know how to answer that. You'd have to tell me what you meant by a breakdown of causality first. And then you'd have to see whether or not.
Tell me what you meant by a continuum.
Well, I think I tried to tell you about it.
Maybe, yes. Maybe we'll take one more question and then we'll call. Since Rafa is here for a long time, these are beginnings of conversation. Okay, I think
but the quantum version of those causal evolutions there, does it not mean that every woman in the world would be like that mother? I mean, are you not making the past probabilistic in this way?
No, I think in this, if we stick, well, let me answer in the context of the classical version, because then something definite can be said. What's happening is that the future of something is just the past time. So, in other words, it's a birth process. So after a certain number of elements are formed, that is a past, if you like. No element will ever be added to the past of any of those elements. That would be to conflict with the intrinsic notion of time. So although the auxiliary time in which the process happens is gauged, we demand it to at least be consistent with the intrinsic time. So I didn't understand, but if I had more time, I should have said that, which is that one of the axioms of the growth leading to this set of growth processes is that no new element is ever born to the past of any existing element.
So that
means that the past is not subject to fluctuation. What is probabilistic is the future. The next element is born, you don't know. Every woman, it's true, every woman is a potential grandparent of that element, unless she's a maximum, unless she has no children at that time. But every woman is a potential mother. But of course, there are no women in that. But take them all with us. It's a potential one, but when the birth occurs, then it becomes definite. Certain of them are the parents, and certain of them are not. And then that never changes.
But do you have to remember that I think the short answer is that you asked about quantum theory, and there isn't any corresponding on the past itself.
So I can
test
the answer.
My main concern is that do you have to approach based like
half a circle?
Is it distinguished future from past? No, absolutely not. That's somehow the main point. That's when I talk about general covariance, that's exactly what it means. There are not
things that I think. So how can you say that the past is classical
fact,
future
is not? Well, the past is relative. So at a given stage of the process, if you give a realization in a particular labeling, there are distinguished types of surfaces. But the more invariant state that would be, pick an element, its past That's a labeling variant. So the past of that particular element is fixed, but the future is variable.
Okay, this is the clear. Since I know this, since I've had the whole course, I know that there's many things to say, to explain all these things, but Raphael is still here for quite some time, so we look forward to much progress and the same, you know, reducing the muches. Increasing the medies and reducing the muches. Thanks very much.
Imagine the concept being invented.